Ready to repair the wall.
Can I grab that?
No.
Thanks. Yeah, first of all, I need to find out who left this at the star party last night. That's yours? Okay.
I also obviously sit there and say, for those of you, obviously, that didn't know we were at 7,000 feet, we drank this up on the mountain. I sealed it. We are now at 900 feet. And this is what air pressure difference there is. Quite crushing. So who had their hand up here?
Yeah, I forgot to bring a stepladder for the telescope last night, so I really do appreciate Ross bringing that bucket so people could actually stand up and get to the telescope. And the company actually found a big, huge rock we could get and stuck it up there. And really appreciate it. I don't know if Tim is here today, but Tim, thank you for bringing your 18-inch telescope. That was a fantastic sight to be able to look through that. And you actually did remember to bring a stepladder. So thank you. And someone else brought a 4-inch telescope. I don't know who I need to thank for that. Oh, Ted, you brought your 4-inch telescope. And we were busy, weren't we? A lot of people showed up. And we got to see a lot of neat things. And it's been, 4 years since we've been to that site. And a little bit surprising how much Rancho Cucamonga has built up in the intervening 4 years. So couldn't quite see the Milky Way. So, but still, it's the best site you're going to find within an easy drive distance of the L.A. Basin. So thank all of you who did come, and it was a great time. And I remember my son's comment, too. He said, Dad, how many stars do you think are really going to show up for your party? And I said, well, about 50 billion trillion. So that sounds a different kind of star party. So get my computer up here. And
40 people there.
Well, 40 at one time. People were coming and going, so I think it was...
I think a couple of them weren't part of our class either. I invited some people to get some coffee and refreshments, and they're like, listen, is it free? Can I have some? They just joined us.
Yeah. Yeah, we had some people drive up and join us, and then, you know, Joe Aguirre, who works for us at Reasons to Believe and does the podcast, he actually mentioned... And last week during one of the podcasts that we were having a star party, that was enough for a family to actually find us. They kind of went online, did searching around, found the Paradox's website, and so they went to a lot of trouble to find out about it. And they were actually the first ones there, so they helped me set up the telescope. So that was really, really kind. So as far as this class goes, Rich Dean here maintains our paradoxes.org website. And as many of you probably know, we get 3 or 4 times as many people participating as actually show up here in class. And thanks to Rich, we're now putting the visuals up as well as the MP3s. So if you know people who can't make it at this time, let them know that both the visuals and the audio will be available. So, in fact, they get to see this class's visuals before we get to see it. So, Ken's book, 7 Truths That Changed the World. To me, it's Ken's best book. And what I like most about the book is how he gives an accumulative case argument for the Christian faith. And it's the best accumulative case argument. It's all there in one table in the middle of the book. The rest of the book kind of fleshes it out, so it'll give you an idea what's going on there. The exciting thing that's happened in these past few weeks is astronomers have finally proven that the universe is flat. And you say, what's so important about that? It's actually something they've been pursuing for over 40 years. So it's been kind of the holy grail of astrophysics to try to prove whether or not the universe is flat. And just the past few weeks, they've finally accomplished what they intended to do. And, you know, flat can be good or bad, right? I mean, everybody wants a flat stomach, so that's kind of considered a good thing. A flat tire is not a good thing. You know, flat champagne's not good, so it can be good or bad. But in this case, it is good. And I'm going to begin with this slide here. This is from the WMAP, the Wilkinson Microwave Anisotropy Probe Satellite. and it's the most accurate map we have to date of the radiation that's left over from the cosmic creation event. Or to put it another way, what you're seeing here in this image is the very first moment after the creation of the universe where we actually see distinctions between light and dark. It's the first time darkness is separated from light. And all those little orange and yellow spots you see there, those become future clusters of galaxies. And astronomers have actually done very detailed map of clusters of galaxies, the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, where they're actually to show that the present-day clusters of galaxies perfectly match those hot spots you see there, and the blue spots, which are the actually match the voids, the spaces in between the clusters of galaxies. And people often ask me, what's the most accurate date we have for the age of the universe, the time back to the cosmic creation event? It actually comes from these maps of the radiation left over from the cosmic creation event. As you can see there, we're now getting down to the third and fourth place of the decimal, 13.75 plus or minus 0.11 billion years ago. But there is an important caveat on this. This date has only one assumption. The one assumption is that date is true if the universe is flat. But if it's not flat, then all bets could be off. And so this is kind of why there's this quest to find out whether or not the universe is flat. It's also trying to understand how our universe is able to sustain life. I mean, as astronomers look at the universe, we're really mystified by how this incredible universe is able to sustain life and advance life in particular. And astronomers beginning 30 years ago began to get an inkling it has to do with the shape of the universe. Well, how do we go about getting the shape of the universe? And by the way, when we talk about whether the universe is flat or spherical or hyperbolic, we're not talking two-dimensional flatness. I want to make that point because that's what we're seeing here in this next figure is two- and three-dimensional flatness. We know the universe has 10 dimensions. You've got length, width, height, you've got time, and you've got six tiny space dimensions that accompany length, width, and height. Length, width, and height are dynamic. They're expanding. The other six dimensions stopped expanding when the universe hit 10 to the minus 43 seconds old. When we talk about a flat universe, we basically mean a universe where the shortest distance between two points is a straight line. So don't worry about the dimensionality, whether it's 2, 3, 9, 10. That's immaterial. And what we mean by flatness is the shortest distance between two points is a straight line. Now, when you look at the cosmic background radiation going back here, what you notice is that you have all these blue spots and yellow and orange spots. And this actually measures the entire sky. So from one end to the other, you're looking at 360 degrees. You're looking literally at the whole sky from the northern hemisphere down to the southern hemisphere. And you know, you have to portray it in some way, and there's just one way you can do it. But this is what's called a whole sky map. And then what astronomers do is they actually measure the angular sizes of the hot and cold spots. So that's what's done here. And the angular sizes of the hot and cold spots tell you what the geometry of the universe is with one assumption. If the universe has a spherical shape, what we call a closed universe, the spots are bigger. And if it's flat, the spots are in between. And then if the universe is open or has a hyperbolic shape, the spots are much tinier again. And you say, what kind of dimensions are we talking about? A flat universe is a universe where the diameters, the angular diameters, the hot and cold spots are about 1 degree across. So if it's less than a degree, then that means we have an open universe. And if it's more than a degree, it's a closed universe. Okay, so that's one way we can get at least an idea of whether or not the universe is flat or open or closed. And then we've come up with what's called the flatness term. It's actually technically called the curvature density of the universe. That's that omega k. So the omega k is the definition of a flat universe. And You take the number one and you subtract the mass density of the universe and what's called the dark energy density or the space energy density. So, another way we can measure whether or not we live in a flat universe or a closed and open universe is actually try to measure the cosmic mass density of the universe and measure the dark energy density of the universe. And when that is done, let me see, I've got... Let me change the figure here because this isn't right. I forgot to save this morning, but I'll take care of it right now while you're not looking.
No pressure.
And I'm going to save this right now so I don't lose this. All right. That will pop this one up. Okay, if all you look at is the maps of the cosmic background radiation, radiation left over from a cosmic creation event, the best you can do in determining how close the universe is to flatness is to come up with those numbers. Those are the very best numbers we have today, independent of any other data. That the universe is between 0.199 and minus 0.199 and plus 0.017. Now, that age I gave you earlier, this age here, for that age to be a reliable measurement, the universe needs to be flat to within about 2%. So it's got to be within about 2% flatness for that number to stand up where you could say we now have got it measured to 3 and 4 places of the decimal. But as you go over to this slide, you notice we're only pinning it down to about plus or minus 10%. So it's not good enough. So we have to go elsewhere besides the cosmic background radiation to try to determine whether or not the universe is flat and therefore whether we got a good handle on the age of the universe. Now, one way that's being done is we have a satellite orbiting the Earth right now called the Planck satellite that the European Space Agency set up. It's designed to measure the cosmic background radiation with about 10 or 20 times more precision than what the WMAP was capable of doing, the NASA experiment. And so with that, we may be able to get a much more accurate figure for the flatness of the universe. But there's actually two other ways we can determine whether or not we live in a flat universe, and that's to measure as accurately as possible the mass density of the universe and the dark energy density. And that can be done independent of maps of the cosmic background radiation by measuring very carefully the rate at which the universe expands throughout cosmic history and by looking at the maps of clusters of galaxies. Remember what I said before? Is that you, these spots that we see in the cosmic background radiation here, if the universe is flat, they should perfectly match where the positions of clusters of galaxies are today. So that's another way we can get at the geometry of the universe. And you say, well, how does measuring the cosmic expansion rate help? Well, the mass of the universe works to slow down cosmic expansion. And I think that's easy to understand. You've got a massive body here, a massive body here. The force of gravity tells us that they will tend to attract one another. And so gravity will work as a brake on the cosmic expansion. But it's a brake that will vary with respect to human history. When the universe is young, the bits and pieces are close together, and so gravity will be stronger in its ability to slow down cosmic expansion. But as the universe gets older, these objects expand away from one another, and gravity gets predictably weaker. And therefore, as we measure the cosmic expansion rate, we would expect that based on the mass of the universe, you're going to get different values of the cosmic expansion rate at different look-back times. Now, dark energy works in the opposite direction. Dark energy, if you remember, is the energy embedded in the space surface of the universe. And the way it works is the larger that space surface becomes, the more powerfully that dark energy accelerates the expansion of the universe. And so as the universe gets older and older, we would expect under the influence of dark energy that the universe would expand at a more and more rapid rate. So what astronomers do is they carefully measure the expansion of the universe at different look-back times. You say, what do you mean by look-back time? Well, people were asking me last night, how far away was M51 and how far away was M49? M49 is a little more than 50 million light years away, which means we're seeing M49. That's a big galaxy in the center of the Virgo cluster of galaxies. We're seeing it as it was 50 million years ago. And so we can measure how fast that galaxy is moving away from us right now, and that tells us how rapidly the universe was expanding 50 million years ago. But we can look at a galaxy that is, say, 12 billion light years away, which tells us how fast the universe was expanding 12 billion years ago, and say, well, how many galaxies have astronomers done that on? They've literally done it on hundreds of thousands of galaxies. So that's been about a 30-year project to measure the expansion rate of the universe by looking at all these galaxies nearby and distant. And by that means, we can actually accurately determine what the mass density of the universe is and the expansion rate of the universe. And so there's been two independent research groups that have actually been trying to get a tighter fit on what's called the curvature density of the universe. And both these papers were published recently in the Astrophysical Journal, the first of which is called the Supernova Legacy Survey, in which they look at the Sloan Digital Sky Survey galaxies and clusters of galaxies, in particular pull up the luminous red galaxies, and then they actually measure supernova eruptions in as many galaxies as they can see in an attempt to measure very precisely the space energy density or the dark energy density and the mass density. And the figure they came up with is that 72.9% of all the stuff of the universe is dark energy, 27.1% is mass. Well, guess what? That adds up to about 1. And they came up with this figure that the universe is very close to being flat, minus 0.002 plus or minus 0.006. And keep in mind that figure I gave you of 13.75 billion, that is accurate and assumption-free if you can prove that the universe is flatter than about 2%. Well, guess what? This is down to 0.2%. So we're 10 times better than what we need. Well, then, just a few weeks ago, the Hubble Space Telescope Cosmology Survey team weighed in with their measurements, and independent of the Supernova Legacy Survey team, they also looked at a supernova population. In this case, they focused on looking at extremely distant supernova, a supernova where you got look-back times of 10, 11, 12 billion years. And they are able to come up with this number, that the universe is flat to within plus 0.002, plus or minus 0.005. Now, you can add the two figures together, and what do you get?
Zero.
Okay, it's flat. But the error bar in that is about plus or minus 0.005, but the whole point is that error bar is a lot smaller than the 2% that you need to prove that the universe is flat. So with great confidence, we can now tell the interested public, I don't know how interested they are in this, that the universe is very close to being perfectly flat. But let me tell you the significance this has for the Christian faith. It's one more piece of proof that we live in an inflationary, hot Big Bang universe. And I've noticed even within the church, there's a lot of people within the church that are challenging the idea that we live in an inflationary universe. I was involved in a conference with a young Earth creationist leaders just a few weeks ago, and they flatly denied that astronomers had proven that we live in an inflationary universe. And so I reminded them that we've got measurements from the cosmic background radiation of what's called the scalar spectral index. I won't go into the technical details of what that all implies in terms of measurements, but what it does mean is that if the scalar spectral index comes in at a value greater than 1.0, then there is no inflation event. And if it comes in at 0.95, then we know that it's a very simple, straightforward inflation with no complex physics involved. But we've had some hints from particle physics independent of cosmology that it almost certainly is complex. And if it's complex, it's going to fall between 0.96 and 0.97. Now notice you don't get anything between 0.97 and 1.0. It's either 0.95, 0.96, 0.97, or 1.0. Now, one of the reasons why we set up the WMAP satellite was to actually determine what the value of the scalar spectral index was. The presumption was that astronomers would never be able to measure the cosmic expansion rates with sufficient precision, so the only way we could prove that we live in an inflationary universe with a somewhat flat geometry was to get at the scalar spectral index. Now, the number they came up with was 0.963 plus or minus 0.012. So, to 99.9% certainty, we know that we live in an inflationary hot Big Bang universe. Now, my friends who are young Earth creationist leaders said 99.9% isn't good enough for us. And moreover, this is just one test. Well, now we have a second independent test that indeed we live in an inflationary universe. Excuse me. Had to go for a run yesterday in a pollen-saturated area, so I've got a little bit of an allergy. Only an inflationary universe will give you a flat geometry. So proving that the universe is flat, and this is what's been the big achievement of the past few weeks, tells us, independent of these cosmic background radiation measurements, that we not only live in a flat universe, it's a flat universe that must have had an inflationary event, because only an inflationary event is going to give you a flat geometry. Now, what I found rather ironic with my young Earth friends is they were arguing so strongly against this inflation event, but if you don't have inflation, then we must be living in a universe that's quadrillions of years old, not just billions of years old. It doesn't really help their case any. It goes the other way. But it's critical that we don't live in a universe that's quadrillions of years old. If we live in a universe that's quadrillions of years old, then that means all the stars are burnt out. And that wouldn't be good for life. I mean, it's nice that the sun is outside there, giving us some heat and light. And you say, well, why don't we just have a universe that is a whole lot smaller? Because that's the whole point about inflation. It really explains how the universe gets as big as it is in such a short period of time. You say, well, couldn't we live with a smaller universe? Well, if you've got a smaller universe, the stars are closer together. And if the stars are closer together, you're going to have gravitational instabilities that are going to mess up your planetary system. So you don't want the stars jammed tightly together. We really do need an inflation event to make the universe as big as it is, as fast as it does, so that the stars are nicely well separated at the time window in which human life is possible. And those of you that are taking that Wednesday night series here in the class will recognize there's an extremely narrow window of time in which human life is possible. The window of time for bacteria is about 4 billion years wide, but the window of time for human civilization is briefer than 40,000 years. There's a number of reasons why it's that brief, about 20 different reasons why it is that brief. But the whole point is you want the universe expanding to a sufficient size so that you have the size you need for advanced life in the narrow window of time in which advanced life is possible. And this is why you need the inflation event. They say, when does the inflation take place? Well, physicists believe that it takes place when you get the strong nuclear force separating out from the other forces of physics. I mean, we got four forces of physics: gravity, electromagnetism, the strong and weak nuclear force. When the universe is 10 to the minus 43 seconds old, that's when gravity separates out from the other three forces, and that causes six of the nine dimensions of space to stop expanding. The second separation occurs at about 10 to the minus 34 seconds, And this is when the strong nuclear force separates out from the electroweak force, and we believe that's what generates the inflation event. You know, strange things happen when forces separate. And we even see that with magnetism and heat, that you get interesting things happening. But that what that inflation event does is it takes the universe from a diameter that's less than the diameter of an electron to the size of a grapefruit in just 10 to the minus 34 seconds. And you say, well, a grapefruit isn't very big, but 10 to the minus 34 seconds isn't very long. You literally have to expand the universe at millions of times faster than the velocity of light during that brief episode to get that universe that big. And this really explains why we have such an enormously large universe in just 14 billion years. But having the universe inflated to that size means that we can have the stars and galaxies far enough apart when stars are middle age. And that's really one of the keys as to why you need the universe as old as it is. Middle-aged stars have sufficient stability to make advanced life possible. And in fact, you have to be almost exactly middle-aged. That's the case of our star, the Sun. It's exactly halfway through its hydrogen-burning cycle. And this is the safe zone, the narrow safe zone in which human life is possible. But you want the stars sufficiently far apart when the stars reach that safe zone. And thanks to inflation, that's exactly what happens. So when you celebrate Thanksgiving, you might want to thank God for the inflation event and the flat universe, and pray that you don't eat so much that your stomach departs from flatness. So
that would be the inflationary period.
That's the inflationary period. But it lasts a lot longer than the inflationary period of the universe.
Yeah, it is question time here, so we can take a few questions.
We can take a few questions, but before I take a few questions, these are the initial results from the Planck satellite. And so you can get an idea that they really are measuring the cosmic background radiation with a lot more precision. But one reason why we have to wait so long to get the final map, they have to subtract out the galaxy. See all that blue stuff there? That's all radiation from our galaxy. That's all got to be subtracted out, which means they have to measure the radiation from our galaxy with just as extremely high precision as they do the cosmic background radiation, because you can tell it's hundreds of times brighter than the background radiation. And so that's what takes them several years of hard work to get that part out so we can get a clean map. So a year or two from now, they've been actually working on this for over 2 years. They got the data, but there's a whole team of astronomers working to subtract off the galactic foreground. And 1 or 2 years from now. And the problem is, the more accurately you measure this thing, the harder it is to subtract off the background. Now I'll take questions. You're first.
What will this still be called, W map or something else?
This is the Planck map.
Planck.
Yeah. Yeah, Planck was a German physicist, and the Germans are putting up most of the money to make this happen, so they get to call it what they want. You're in the back. Yeah.
Me?
No. The guy directly behind you. Then I'll get to you.
You're talking about the expansion event basically portraying it as a grapefruit, which is round, but the galaxy is basically flat. The universe is basically flat. At what point did it go from round to flat?
Oh, I'm not saying it was round. I mean, this is the problem with trying to communicate this.
I know.
We astronomers understand we're talking a 10-dimensional geometric system, which is impossible to visualize.
Right.
But in order for NASA and the ESA to maintain their funding, they have to communicate to the public. They do it through pictures, but the pictures have their limitations. So what we're talking, what you need to think about is, okay, something smaller than an electron becoming something bigger or the size of a grapefruit, and forget about the shape that you're trying to visualize in your mind. It's roughly that kind of stretching out or inflation that we're dealing with.
It only expands, not this way.
It expands in all directions. So it's expanding over all, the six dimensions don't expand, but length, width, height, and time do expand. Yes.
Well, mine is really the same question. When something blows up, it expands in a big, like a fireworks that you see. So how is it flat?
Here's where the analogy breaks down. Do not think of it as like pulling a pin from a grenade and it explodes. It's not like that, because the expansion is restrained to the surface alone. And so like when you pull a pin from a grenade, some of the pieces move slowly, some of the pieces move quickly. In the case of the universe, they all move at exactly the same velocity. So everything stays right on the surface. There's nothing interior to the surface. There's nothing exterior to the surface. And what we're saying is the surface has gotten that much bigger in that brief period of time. And don't try to visualize the shape. That can't be done. But that's an extremely rapid inflationary event. And there's one more benefit to that inflation. By inflating the universe that rapidly in that short of a period of time enables you to have the universe thermally connected, where every other part of the universe is thermally linked to every other spot in the universe. And this is what you need to keep the universe very uniform and very homogeneous. And that's a critical requirement for life, that we live in a universe that's extraordinarily homogeneous and uniform. You say, why? Well, if it's not, you wind up with a universe that is nothing but black holes and neutron stars. And that's a universe that can never sustain life, because there you're looking at densities that exceed 2 billion tons per level teaspoonful, which means molecules are not possible, atoms are not possible, not even protons and electrons are possible in such a universe. And clearly life needs all that. So you want the universe uniform and homogeneous, which means it's got to be thermally connected. And the only way to keep it thermally connected, if you want a really big universe, is to hyperinflate it at an early episode. I don't know who was first here, but go for it.
Well, I understand. Atheism used to demand that you had a universe that didn't have a beginning, like the Big Bang, because there were profound implications to a definite event of the universe coming into being. But why did the young earthers demand a non-flat universe? Are they trying to arrive at a universe that they think all of these objections are going to create the young?
No, it's basically a negative argument from the young Earth community. What they're really saying is, yeah, we got problems trying to figure out why the universe looks the way it does in the young Earth paradigm, but you old Earth creationists also have problems. Your problem is you can't explain how the universe is thermally connected if it's billions of years old. You should need quadrillions of years, not so you guys have got a big problem too. The difference is, we can solve our problem, they can't solve their problems. There's no way they can resolve the light travel time problem in any of their models. But we can resolve the light travel time problem in our model through a hyperinflation event, which is why they've been so adamant that astronomers cannot prove that the universe had an inflation event. They can't prove it as a flat geometry. We can do both. But I like what you said at the beginning. You've got atheists out there who are critiquing the idea that the universe actually has a space-time beginning. Proving that the universe had an early aggressive inflationary event adds to the weight of evidence that the universe really did have a space-time beginning that only goes back 14 billion years. And so it's actually a three-way debate. You've got atheists who in some contexts are trying to make the universe eternal. You know, I was talking recently about Lawrence Krauss's latest book, A Universe from Nothing. He admits that our universe has a beginning, but he's trying to claim it's part of a larger system which has no beginning. And so demonstrating the universe has a beginning, a real space-time beginning, then establishes that the atheists are wrong, that it really is only billions of years old. It can't be infinitely old.
And how could they prove it's part of something else? I mean, that's really just a philosophical argument, right? Outside science, if you will.
Right, and you can read my critique of Lawrence Krauss's book. It's up on our website in two parts. I think both parts are now up there. And the problem is he keeps talking about how physicists have proven that the universe comes from nothing, and he's got four different examples of how that could be, but every one of his examples, his definition of nothing actually is something. So, as I said in my critique, it kind of reminded me of my younger son telling his mother years ago when she asked him, what's under your bed? He said, nothing. His definition was, nothing I want you to find out about. So he didn't really mean it was actually nothing. Yes, go ahead.
You're saying that there's four elements at the beginning. Hydrogen, what was it? Hydrogen, oxygen, helium. Four elements that were produced at the very beginning.
At the very beginning, you have just one element, hydrogen.
Okay, and then what comes? There's supposed to be four main elements of life, right? Or four.
Well, in the Big Bang creation event, the universe will expand. As it expands, it gets cooler and cooler. And for a brief moment of time, it's in that window where nuclear fusion will take place. And so some of the hydrogen gets fused into helium as the universe expands. And because of the mass of our universe, that takes place in 20 seconds. So in a 20-second window, the universe is operating like a star, converting hydrogen into helium. But that's all it makes, is just helium. It doesn't make anything else, although it does make trace amounts, I should say, of lithium and of boron and beryllium, but very trace amounts. It's almost all helium. Everything else comes from stars. However, the amount of helium that you get in the first 4 minutes of the cosmic history determines what elements the stars will make. And so if we were to take longer than that 20 seconds, or less than that 20 seconds, you wind up with a universe that lacks the carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, and phosphorus that's necessary for life. So that's where those other elements
so
come in.
So the hydrogen came from what? From the...
Now, hydrogen's there as soon as you get protons and neutrons.
And there was another thing about electromagnetism, gravity. When do they cut the four?
You get four forces of physics, yeah. And they start off as a that's what unified field theory is all about,
right.
Where the universe begins with just one force, and as the universe cools, it becomes two, then it becomes three, then it becomes four. And if you want an analogy, take a bar magnet and heat it. If you heat a bar magnet up enough, the magnetism disappears. It appears to disappear because when you cool the magnet, it returns. And what's happening is by heating the magnet, you're causing those two forms of energy to blend together. And as you cool the magnet, they separate. Well, the same thing happens with the four fundamental forces of physics. As the universe cools, they separate. But when they separate, you get interesting phase effects that take place.
At what point did those four phases come into being? At the age of what age was the universe?
Okay. You get one force of physics until the universe reaches 10 to the minus 43 seconds,
right.
At which point you've got two forces of physics.
Right.
And about 10 to the minus 34 seconds, you go from two forces of physics to three forces of physics. And then you get the fourth force when the universe, I forget the exact number, I think it's something like 10 to the minus 17 seconds, you get four forces of physics. And this is why physicists have been after you to fund things like the Large Hadron Collider, because what they can do with the Large Hadron Collider is actually reproduce the temperature conditions when these forces would have been blended together. And so we've actually got particle accelerator experiments that will bring about the fusion of electromagnetism and the weak nuclear force. And thanks to the Large Hadron Collider, we can see some of the elements, only a few of the elements, that would lead to the fusion of the strong nuclear force with the electroweak force.
So that first 20 seconds, God was very, very, very busy.
Extremely busy. In fact, he's extremely busy in the first second. A lot happens in the first second.
In the first second, but... I was just curious as to all these elements and hydrogen and helium and the four elements. And this all came about within 20 seconds, basically, you're saying.
No, it happens between, the fusion takes place in 20 seconds.
Yeah.
The timing of that happens between 3 and 3.5 minutes after the cosmic creation event.
3 and 3.5 minutes.
Are
you saying that God literally... I hate to use that word I used it last week, sort of conducting this thing together, sort of,
Particle physicists have actually used that word picture of the creator like the conductor of an orchestra commanding these different things to happen at just the right time. That's called the symphony of the universe. That's one of the terms they use for it.
Right, so is that what you believe, that God was literally kind of...
You can see fine-tuning miracles all the way through the first split second. In fact, one physicist wrote a book called The First Millisecond, where he just talks about all the amazing things happen before the universe hits 0.001 second. So, at the four forces that come out there, all the particles appear during that time, and they appear in just the right numbers and the relationships with one another that it predicts what stars will look like billions of years later. So, yeah, God was very busy during that first millisecond after the cosmic creation event.
But the laws were still in effect. I mean, the physical laws, he started it, but then the physical laws sort of...
The physical laws were all set up there at the beginning. That's one thing that astronomers have been able to demonstrate. There's been no change in the laws of physics throughout cosmic history.
Since the very, okay.
Now, astronomers have been able to prove that. In fact, one of the papers I'm not talking about here literally was published in just this past week's Astrophysical Journal, a new demonstration that the laws of physics don't change over cosmic history. But guess who said it first? It was Moses, Isaiah, Jeremiah. They were the first to speak about the constancy of the laws of physics. That the laws of physics that God sets up when he creates the universe remain in effect until evil is conquered and removed. Only then will the laws of physics change. Yes. And then we're going to cut the questions and get on to our lesson in Psalm 139.
The flat universe, does it have any ramifications for the philosophy of multiverse?
It can. Some inflationary models will allow for space-time bubbles to arise during the inflation event. And so that's one of the reasons why we're trying to determine exactly what kind of inflationary hot Big Bang model we're talking about. However, these would be space-time bubbles that would be akin to the space-time bubble we live in, which means they're still subject to the Borde, Guth, Blenkin theorem, which proves there must be a causal agent beyond space and time that created how many bubbles ever show up. But one of the inflationary models indeed predicts that you would get a huge number of these space-time bubbles, most of which would quickly dissipate, leaving one, namely our universe, which would be a habitat for life. So, yeah, when the Planck data comes back, we may be able to give you an answer to that question. Okay, very back, and then I'm going to cut things off. Go ahead.
Does this flatness finding affect whether the universe will ever collapse back in on itself or expand forever?
Okay, if the universe is perfectly flat, it's going to expand until God puts a stop to it. And it's going to expand faster and faster as time goes on. Because we're not only proving that the universe is flat, and if the universe is flat, it's guaranteed under any cosmology it will not re-collapse. However, not only showing that the universe is flat, we're showing that most of the flatness comes from dark energy. That being the case, it's going to expand faster and faster as time goes on. And hey, if you want to know where it began to transition, 5 billion years ago, the universe transitioned from slowing down to speeding up. And so, yeah, next year, it'll expand faster. And one of the questions I got last night, by the way, it was interesting. We were looking at the stars and galaxies, and I was being hit with all these apologetics questions. But somebody was concerned last night just how much their waistline would expand due to dark energy. And I let them know that it's really not measurable, so you can't really blame. And it is true that you'd expect your waistline to expand at an accelerated rate as the universe gets older and older. But the thing is that at local distances, where the distances are small, the effects of gravity dominate. And so the fact that the protons and neutrons in your body are so close together means that they will exert a gravity which will sustain your waistline at a level that dark energy can't impact. The only way that dark energy works is if you've got a really, really big body, and nobody in this classroom has got a body big enough that they can blame any part of its expansion on dark energy.
Can't blame it on dark energy.
It only really is measurable when you're looking at large separations between the massive bodies. That's significant because if you look at our local group of galaxies, the effect of dark energy really is far below the effect of local gravity. And so, it's, in fact, people have done that. They've tried to measure the impact of dark energy within our galaxy and in the nearest galaxies, too. It can be done, but it's extremely difficult because of the fact that the effect of mass completely predominates. And so, yeah, at your waistline, forget about it. Okay, let's actually get into some of our lesson for today. I mean, this is, by the way, this I think is Nobel Prize winning stuff, what these astronomers have done. So we'll see how much attention it gets here. But and I really am excited just how much it means for a universe that can sustain life. But this is where we left off in our study of Psalm 139. Let me pull it up. I won't get into the details of this, but we spent a lesson, and you can get it off the MP3 if you missed it, on how we calibrate the Genesis 5 and 11 genealogies, which puts the time of God creating Adam at roughly 60,000 years ago, plus or minus 30,000 years. And the point here is this is well before the Neolithic Revolution, which dates to about 11,000 years ago. And likewise, you can use the same calibration to crudely come up with a date for Noah at about 40,000 years ago, plus or minus 15,000 years. Now, I want you to keep these two dates in mind, roughly 60 and roughly 40, because we're going to compare them with three different scientific databases. And kind of what I'm going with here is God gave us two books, the Book of Nature and the Book of Scripture. And for the first time, we're actually able to test the concordance of God's two books on the origin of humanity and the date for humanity. Now, one of the ways we can do that is by looking at what science has got to say about the Genesis flood. And then we're going to actually look at the dates for cultural big bangs, and finally the most controversial stuff of all, the DNA dates. But actually, I'm beginning what I think is a little more reliable here. And let me begin first with a map of the Arabian Peninsula as it looks today. And I put a couple of place names in here, or three place names. And these three place names are all mentioned in Genesis 2. Genesis 2 tells us that the Tigris and the Euphrates River flow through the land of Asher. Now, that's fairly easy to identify as you read out through the rest of the Bible. Clearly, it's referring to Assyria or Mesopotamia or the Babylonian lands. It's the Mesopotamian floodplain that exists there north and west of the Persian Gulf. And then it tells us that the Pishon flows out of the mountains of Havilah. And the mountains of Havilah describes various minerals that are there, gold, etc. The mountains of Havilah are in the central western portion of the Arabian Peninsula. And then it talks about the Gihon that flows out of Cush. And Cush is typically identified with Ethiopia and the Horn of Africa. But it talks about these four rivers coming together in the locale of the Garden of Eden. And this has been the difficulty with Bible scholars trying to identify the location of the Garden of Eden. And this is satellite imagery, and if you go online, you can get a high-resolution map of this. And what's interesting about that high-resolution map, it will show you the riverbeds of once mighty flowing rivers. Now, this is what the Middle East roughly looked like 40 to 50,000 years ago. Where you got almost all of the Red Sea dry and almost all of the Persian Gulf dry. You say, how come? Because we're at the close of the last ice age. The last ice age lasted 90,000 years. In fact, you can in one sense say that the ice age is still upon us, because you can go into parts of the world where you can still see the receding of glaciers from the last ice age. But this was a time when the mountains of Cush down here were covered with snow and ice, likewise the mountains of Havilah, and because they were covered with snow and ice, and because the ice age was beginning to end, that snow and ice was melting, and therefore it was feeding these two great rivers. Now, that's still the case for the Tigris and Euphrates, because there are mountains to the north of the Mesopotamian plain that are permanently snow-covered. And so if you look at Mount Ararat, for example, it's got a very heavy cover of snow and ice. That snow and ice melts, and it feeds the Tigris and Euphrates River, even though almost no rain falls in the Mesopotamian plain. It's getting it from the mountains. Those rivers still flow. The Gihon and the Pishon no longer flow because the snow and the ice is gone. And, you know, this is a place where it doesn't rain much. So you're not going to be able to feed the rivers with the current rainfall. So with the snow and ice gone, they're gone. Those rivers are no longer flowing. But with satellite imagery, we can see where those great rivers existed. And satellite imagery tells us that the Gihon and the Pishon were actually bigger rivers than the Tigris and Euphrates are today. Although keep in mind, if you go back 40 and 50,000 years, the Tigris and Euphrates would be much bigger rivers than they are today because there's more snow and ice melt in the mountains surrounding the Mesopotamian plain. Excuse me. But yeah, if you go online and look at a high-resolution image, what you'll see is a riverbed that flows right through here up into these mountains. And if you, again, you'll see another one that flows very close to it, but it goes up into these mountains with many tributaries. You can see that with satellite imagery. And so the two rivers come out here. The Tigris and Euphrates come out here. And let me show you on the next slide what's happening here. This would be Asher, Havilah, and Cush that are mentioned in Genesis 2. And here you got the Garden of Eden and the land of Nod, which is to the east of Eden, according to Genesis chapter 4. So this is one way to reconcile Genesis 2 with the scientific evidence. And that's been a major critique of skeptics against Genesis 2. It says four rivers come together. It's impossible for the four rivers to come together. Therefore, the text of Genesis 2 in no way can be reliable, inspired scripture from the one that created the universe. Well, if you put it back in the appropriate time context of roughly 40,000 years ago, the four rivers can come together in one locale because almost all the Persian Gulf is dry. Now, if you go on our website, you'll see an article that I wrote a few months ago where they found the earliest Neolithic villages on the face of the earth. The Neolithic Revolution is when humans first began to build towns and roads and trade with one another and specialize in different activities. They've actually found 60 Neolithic villages all around the present Persian Gulf, right at the shoreline, the present-day shoreline. They've been able to date these villages. Indeed, they date back to about 11,000 years ago, the very earliest dates we have for the Neolithic Revolution. And the British archaeologists who found these villages commented, the fact that these villages are so numerous compared to other Neolithic finds and are all at the edge of the current Persian Gulf tells us that these people must have been reacting to a rapid rise of sea level in the Persian Gulf. In other words, they were living in what we call the Persian Gulf oasis, and as the water began to rise, they began to move their settlements up along the shore, and how this explains the 60 villages there. In fact, the archaeologist that discovered this says, it'd be great if we can get a grant and actually begin to explore underwater in the Persian Gulf and see if we can find additional evidence. Well, he made two caveats. His caveat number one, he was trying to explain why his funding request might get denied. He says, number one, if they are reacting to a rise of sea level, and the fact that all these villages are just around the Persian Gulf means they're probably reacting to a catastrophe. If that's the case, it might destroy all the archaeological evidence that's in the Persian Gulf. So if it's there, we might not find it. And number two, he says, this seems to be a hot war zone right now, and various governments around the Persian Gulf may not like us doing this kind of research. Kind of a nod to Iran not being too happy about this happening, especially since it would be lending credence to the Judeo-Christian faith rather than their Islamic faith. So he says, I'm applying for the funding, but I'm not sure I'm going to get it. Okay. Okay, they found settlements literally all around the current rim of the Persian Gulf. So they found some settlements here. They found a whole bunch along here. The highest density was right in here, is where they found the villages. And they also found evidence that villages farther up. So it indicates that they probably were reacting to a catastrophe, because they found some villages that are 1,000 feet above the current Persian Gulf level, and not in a very good place to put villages. And the reaction is, it seems like a response to fear, that the sea levels were rising quickly, and so they kind of went overboard and went far beyond what was necessary to sustain things. Yes?
Trying to put this in some context, I'm thinking of Noah's flood 40,000 years ago and these villages 11,000 years ago, so they're way after the flood.
They're way after the flood, right.
Okay, so catastrophic events at that time would not be related to the flood itself.
Not related to the flood. These would be post-flood catastrophes.
Okay, but still that very narrow area is 11,000 years ago where the center of humanity still was by that time.
Let me take you to the next slide, because this is what I think the flood of Noah would look like, is that it would actually inundate that whole area, okay? And this is probably what the post-flood looked like. And so you'd wind up with a lot of the Persian Gulf becoming land and a lot of the Red Sea becoming land, but not completely dry. And therefore, that would lead to a scenario of a gradual filling in of the Persian Gulf, which could lead to some of the scenarios that this British archaeologist is referring to. So this is what it would have looked like before the flood of Noah. And it explains where we get the Garden of Eden. So it solves a problem in Genesis chapter 2, but also solves a problem, a lot of problems, with a flood event. And I see that my time is up, but we do have a DVD there in a table where we talk in detail about this particular event, where all that water came from and how it quickly subsided after the flood and returned it to a condition like this, and how the dates and the description match what we see in the Bible, and then this is what it looks like today. So this is where Eden would be today. So I'll get into some of the details later, but we're going to move from there to the evidence for the cultural big bangs, and then the really big challenge to interpreting the first 11 chapters, and for that matter, Romans 5, 6, 7, and 8, as inspired scripture coming from the genomic study of human DNA, and what are some of the new studies that we have based on animal DNA that I think set everything just right. So that's kind of what you got to look forward to in the next few weeks. Let's bow for prayer. Father in heaven, we thank you that we live in such an amazing time as the beginning of the 21st century. Lord, when we're learning so much from your book of nature, thank you, Father, that we've got disciplines where the knowledge base literally doubles every 4 years. And Father, thank you for how we can take advantage of that expanding database to strengthen our own faith in you and your inspired scripture in the Bible, but also develop new tools that we can use to bring skeptics to faith in Jesus Christ. So Lord, I pray that you would equip us so we may effectively give reasons for the hope within us with gentleness, respect, and a clear conscience. In Jesus' name, amen.
I have one quick announcement. I have an international Bible student that's here, and his ride didn't show up to class. If there's anybody here that lives in El Monte or near El Monte, he's looking for a ride to get back to his dormitory in El Monte. So if you could come up and... there he is over here. So if you're in El Monte, and if you're heading that direction, if you could give him a hand, we'd appreciate it. Thank you.